Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Professor Jeremy Da Silva, the author of First Steps, How Outpriced Walking Made Us Human, Blending History, Science, and Culture, a highly engaging evolutionary story exploring how walking on two legs allowed humans to become the planet's dominant species. Humans are the only mammals to walk on two rather than four legs, a locomotion known as bipedalism. We strive to be upstanding citizens, honor those who stand tall and proud, and take a stand against injustices. We follow in each other's footsteps and celebrate a child's beginning to walk. But why and how exactly did we take our first steps? And at what cost? Bipedalism has its drawbacks. Giving birth is more difficult and dangerous. Our running speed is much slower than other animals. And we suffer a variety of ailments, from hernias to sinus problems. In First Steps, paleoanthropologist Jeremy Da Silva explores how unusual and extraordinary this seemingly ordinary ability is, a 7 million year journey to the very origins of the human lineage. First Steps shows how upright walking was a gateway to many of the other attributes that make us human, from our technological abilities, our thirst for exploration, our use of language. It may have laid the foundations for our species, traits of compassion, empathy, and altruism. Moving from developmental psychology labs to ancient fossil sites throughout Africa and Eurasia, Da Silva brings to life our adventure walking on two legs. Delving deeply into the story of our past, the new discoveries, rewriting our understanding of human evolution, First Steps examines how walking upright helped us rise above all other species on this planet. Well, Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as we're living through these unprecedented times, I'd like to ask, how has the pandemic influenced you and your work?
It's a great question. I live in Vermont. We've been very fortunate to not be impacted too severely by the pandemic. My kids still can go to in-person school. We've been so grateful to the community and the teachers because teaching from home, homeschooling our kids, which we did at the start of the pandemic in the spring, made balancing work and homeschooling impossible. It was very, very difficult. And so I really feel for my colleagues who are homeschooling their children right now. We've been so fortunate here in Vermont. But it's impacted my research in a number of ways. I've turned to more local projects. And so we have a paper coming out this week on the redating, the carbon dating of a mammoth fossil that was found in Vermont in 1848. I didn't think I'd be interested or doing work on mammoths, on woolly mammoths, but sure enough, that's what a pandemic will do. It forces you to be a little more nimble and to do local projects. But what's happening with human evolution that I think is quite interesting is that folks that have projects where there are collaborators in Africa, mostly Eastern Africa and Southern Africa, where I work, if we have partners there that continue to do the work, we can still describe fossils that are being excavated. That's happening with a new site in South Africa, for instance, that my colleague Lee Berger is excavating. And so in some ways, it's helping decolonize our science, where if you are an American scientist who just swoops into one of these countries and does your work and finds fossils without having strong partners, colleagues that are scientists in those countries, then your work is not really possible anymore. And so, you know, that to me is a silver lining, because the decolonization of our science has been something that's been sorely needed for a long time.
Well, I suppose if somebody asks you, what have you been doing during the pandemic? Oh, well, I baked some sourdough bread, carbon dated mammoths, and decolonized science. Oh, dear.
I mean, my colleagues are way ahead of me on that one. There have been moments of productivity and moments, plenty of moments of despair as well. But yeah, the carbon dating of the mammoth has certainly been fun.
So can you perhaps tell us how you coped with some of these moments of despair?
That's a great question. You know, I've got an incredibly wonderful and supportive wife, and my two kids have just been an amazing joy. I have 10-year-old twins, and they have this seemingly unending optimism and hope about the world. And they're so flexible. They've just been, seeing the world through their eyes has helped. During these times, and it has honestly given me quite a bit of hope in the future. My students as well, not just my children, but my students. I've continued to teach remotely at Dartmouth College. We haven't been doing too much in-person teaching, so I've been teaching remotely, and I am just constantly awed by my students and what they know, how they think, the way they can turn information into knowledge, and just their passion for making necessary changes in the world. I'm looking forward to when they are our leaders.
Oh, that's so refreshing to hear from the mentor.
I think it's a remarkable generation that is coming up right now.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit more about your background?
Sure. So I grew up in Massachusetts, in New England, which is where I teach now. So I'm sort of still home. And I've always been interested in science. As a kid, I loved science. It was always my favorite subject. But I never quite knew what I wanted to do, which I tell my students now is totally okay. I dabbled in college with astrophysics. But then the math really crushed me once we got to advanced math that didn't even have numbers anymore. It was just letters and exponents. I really struggled with that. And I ended up graduating with a degree in physiology, animal physiology. And I thought maybe I wanted to be a vet. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I got a job at the Boston Museum of Science, as an educator. And, I fell in love with science all over again. It wasn't about what we knew. It was about what we didn't know and how we could find things out. It wasn't about getting the answers right on an exam anymore, the way I sort of had that experience in college. It was really about the questions you ask and the way you wonder about your world. You know, why is it this way? And how do we know the things we claim to know about the world. So I taught there for several years. The way I got into human evolution was we had a small exhibit on these very famous footprints from a site in Tanzania called Laetoli. And the footprints were positioned close enough to our dinosaur exhibit that it was, to me, a little unsettling that we could be spreading misconceptions about, you know, those toy packs that have dinosaurs and ancient humans and mammoths in the same bundle, right? And they just call them, you know, ancient animals. And it's no. These things didn't live at the same time. There has been such an extraordinary geological time scale of Earth that you know, these different creatures lived at different times. So let's not spread that misconception. Let's move these prints into our human evolution and human biology exhibit. And I talked to my boss, Lucy Kirshner, and she said, okay, that's great, but I want you to learn everything you can about human evolution before we do this. And I went to our museum library and I read some books by Ian Tattersall, who's the curator at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And I got hooked. I got absolutely pulled into this world of ancient human fossils and the stories that they tell us, the evidence that you can pull from these fossils tell us not only about these broad themes of how evolution unfolded, but each one of these fossils was an individual, somebody that was that lived and breathed and ate and talked and laughed and cried and had this had a life. And from their bones that they left us, not willingly, of course, but through these incredible circumstances of fossilization, we're so lucky to have these fossils. And they tell us these amazing stories about our ancestors, both large scale and also these individual stories. I was hooked. Oh God, I'd found my passion. And I left the museum and I started graduate school with Laura McClatchy, first at Boston University and then at the University of Michigan, which was where I ended up focusing on locomotion and how our ancestors moved in terms of their climbing ability, but also I ended up getting quite interested in the evolution of upright walking, which is what my book is about.
So a part of your unbridled curiosity for science, have you always been passionate about teaching and science communication, as you do very well in this book?
Thanks. I really appreciate that. I really didn't. In college at least, that was not something I thought too much about. I did write. I had a column in our newspaper, our college newspaper, my junior and senior year, and it was always about science, and it was always about sort of, you know, science literacy. And a lot of that was inspired by one of my favorite science authors and science communicators, and that was Carl Sagan, who was a professor at Cornell when I was there. And he died my junior year, but I had an opportunity to hear him speak, and he was a guest lecturer or an attendee, I should say, for a couple of classes that I took when I was an astrophysics major. And wow, he was so inspirational and modeled scientific discourse so beautifully of, you know, he defined science as a marriage of skepticism and wonder. And I've always loved that you can, you know, with a new discovery, I always see it as, wow, that's amazing. And there's the wonder part. And then it has to be followed by, but how do we know that? Where's the evidence? And there's the skepticism. And if you go too far to either side, then you really lose the spirit of science. It has to walk that fine line between skepticism and wonder. But no, I don't think I was a good science communicator until I went to the Museum of Science. And at the museum, there are dedicated educators, and there are dedicated educators in science museums all over the world, who really understand how to teach people science. They understand what the strategies should be. They understand what the barriers sometimes are to people's understandings. You know, I had some amazing mentors at the Museum of Science that, you know, would be teaching a four-year-old one moment and then turn to their grandparent the next, and without even seemingly, you know, a shift in their sentence, they're educating both. And to me, that was just magical. And I learned so much from my mentors at the Museum of Science. And a lot of that I've tried to carry over into what I do now. But it's hard because as a scientist, you don't write that way anymore. You're taught to write in a different kind of way. And teaching in a classroom is not the same as teaching in a hands-on museum experience. It's been honestly writing this book. I had to tap into, you know, that museum world that was a part of my daily life, and to remember and recall how it was that I had these conversations with visitors to find my voice again, to make sure that this book would be accessible to the general public. I didn't write this book for my colleagues. This is a book for the general public.
Well, that's a great example of transferable skills.
Yeah.
So how did you come to writing this book?
So that's a great question. I love to read, and one of my favorite authors, who actually lives close to where I teach in New Hampshire, is Mary Roach. And Mary Roach has written these absolutely beautiful books on seemingly ordinary things. Books about eating. She has one called Gulp on the digestive system. She has one called Stiff on what happens after we die. And that's, of course, not an ordinary thing, but it's just, you know, it's something that is just not something I think we as a society think about very often. And she's got one called Bonk on sex, which I suppose is probably something people do think about more than the others. But I was so fascinated by what I was learning about upright walking and the evolution of upright walking, and just how odd it is that humans move on two legs as a mammal. If we look around our world, we see mammals that mostly move around on all fours. Think about your dog or cat, squirrels, horses, cows, goats, you know, pigs, they're moving on all fours. There are mammals that fly, bats. There are mammals that swim, like dolphins. Mammals can swing through the trees like a gibbon. But most mammals just move on all fours. There's no other mammal that does what we do. And when they do, when a mammal does move on two legs, we lose our minds. We take out our cameras, we videotape them moving on two legs, we post it to YouTube, and there are millions of hits, right? It becomes an internet sensation. A couple of years ago, there was a gorilla named Lewis in the Philadelphia Zoo who was videotaped walking on two legs. And it was on the NBC Nightly News that this gorilla was moving on two legs. And so there's something here, right? It's so strange that we walk on two legs, and yet it's so ordinary. It's so pedestrian, right? Even that word, pedestrian, means ordinary. And so I saw an opportunity to write a book about how actually it's amazing. It's a really, really amazing thing with an incredible evolutionary story that not only informs how we got to be the way we are today. I think upright walking, as I can go into, set the stage for many of the other evolutionary changes that happened over the course of our lineage. But it continues to impact us today in how we give birth to our children, in how we parent them, in how we handle injuries, and just how vulnerable we are to falls and to musculoskeletal injuries as a result of this form of locomotion. And so I, you know, to get sort of into the nitty-gritty of this, I was contacted when I was at Boston University. I was a professor there, and I was contacted by Esmond Harmsworth, who's an agent at Avitus. And he asked me, he had seen a write-up on some of my work on some South African fossils in which we reconstructed in detail how these 2 million-year-old ancestors of ours walked, and sort of brought them back to life and got them walking again. And he asked if I was interested in writing a book. And I said, yes, but not until I have tenure. And so it wasn't until I went to Dartmouth and got tenure that I then contacted him again and said, yeah, I'd love to write this book.
Excellent. Okay, so let's dive into a bit of a science then. Mm-hmm. And can you describe how come human locomotion is so unique? And in terms that you already mentioned, so how does it differ from ape or even bears sometimes are seen on two legs?
Yeah. So when any other animal, when any other mammal, I should say, because birds are bipedal, birds can walk on two legs quite easily. And in part, it's because they evolved from bipedal dinosaurs. So if you think about T-Rex running around on two legs or Velociraptor, that you know, humans being bipedal is not unique to all of life on Earth. We see this in birds and in their predecessors. But it's among mammals that it's unusual. And you're right that if you're going to see bipedalism in another mammal, typically in terms of locomotion, you see it posturally, like a prairie dog or a meerkat will stand up on two legs to look at the horizon and peer over great distances. But in terms of locomotion, actually getting from point A to point B, the animals that typically do it the most are primates, so monkeys and apes, although you're right that bears will occasionally move on two legs as well. But when they do it, it's a very energetically inefficient way to move. They'll wobble from side to side. Usually their knees and their hips are bent. And I'll you know, recommend to your listeners, if you want to know how energetically inefficient it is to move that way, bend your knees, bend your hips, like the famous Groucho Marx actor that used to walk around with that crouched gait. Try that and walk around, and it won't be long before your quads are absolutely burning because they're using all this.
Yeah, absolutely. I would really recommend our listeners to try. So yeah, it's a great experiment.
Right. So that's a bad, evolutionarily, that's not something that's going to be beneficial. That's not something that's going to succeed. And so what we see over the course of human evolution, we see it quite early on, actually, are anatomical adaptations in our ancestors that allowed them to not tip over when they were walking. Some of those changes happened at the hip joint with modifications to the pelvis. And so when they stood on a single leg, they didn't just fall over to the other leg as chimpanzees do when they wobble back and forth on two legs. And we can see that in fossil pelvises that are, the oldest one we have is about 4.5 million years old, that already has that modification that would support what is called an Ardipithecus ramidus on a single leg when it was walking on two. And then we have evidence at the knee joint and even inferences from footprints that our early ancestors, again, were not crouched over like that evolution imagery would have you think, you know, the chimpanzee slowly turning into the human that you see on bumper stickers and T-shirts and coffee cups. There's a lot of evidence that we probably didn't go through a stage where we were bent over, bent-kneed, bent-hipped because of how energetically exhausting it is. And instead, our ancestors would have been more upright quite early on from the get-go. We have a lot of fossils still to find to really nail that down. But for now, it looks to me, at least from the evidence that we have, that uprightness, extended knee, extended hip, posture in locomotion is deeply rooted in our ancestry. And that's one of the really fun things I think about the fossil record is that what we've learned through genetics, what we've learned through molecular anthropology, is that humans are very closely related to the African great apes. And in particular, we are the sister taxa. We are the first cousins of chimpanzees and bonobos. And we can tell by examining the differences in DNA that we share a common ancestor with chimpanzees and bonobos that lived about 6 million years ago. Now, this often will lead folks to think that we therefore evolved from chimpanzees, and we didn't. We share a common ancestor with them, and that common ancestor was a more generalized ape from which chimpanzees and humans independently diverged. So when we look at the fossil record, if we go back that far and say, okay, well, what's there? What do we have that's 4, 5, 6, 7 million years old that gives us some insight into what this animal looked like and what it was doing? We don't have much. The fossils are so rare from that time period. There's a skull from the Central African country of Chad. There's a femur from Kenya. And there is a toe bone from Ethiopia. And those are all north of 5 million years old. So they're between 5 and 7 million. And all of them show hints of upright walking. And so when we compare ourselves to chimpanzees, there are all these ways that humans are different from our ape cousins. We have bigger brains. We're more technologically reliant. We have smaller canine teeth. We have less body hair. We have language, we have culture, and it can go on and on and on. And if you then look at the fossils to try to figure out, okay, well, what came first? What were the initial changes that really set us off on this unique path? What we find is bipedalism. It's upright locomotion. And there's even evidence, if you go back even farther than that, to fossils that are 9, 10, 11 million years old. And these are mostly found in Southern Europe. There's some evidence that those apes, those ancient apes, were more bipedal, were more upright than a modern chimpanzee is. And so again, we think of humans as being often, you know, there are misconceptions that we think of humans as more evolved than our ape cousins, but it could very well be that the body from which we evolved bipedalism was already quite upright, and that knuckle walking in chimpanzees and bonobos and in gorillas is a more derived, more recent form of locomotion. This is a hot topic in our field right now. It's debated quite a bit. The field is pretty split on this, and we're going to need more fossils to really figure out if which of these hypotheses is correct. But it is possible. And I think the evidence right now is consistent with the idea that knuckle walking is actually derived. It's the new form of locomotion from something that was not bipedal on the ground like us. That's not what I'm saying, but something that was a little more upright and maybe moving bipedally in the trees.
Interesting. So I have two questions relating to what you mentioned, that being upright requires quite a lot of balance. So one first question is about kangaroos. So they are technically bipedal, but they use their tail for locomotion, or?
That's right. So they're absolutely bipedal, but they're not striding bipeds like we are. And so that's an important qualifier that I should have mentioned at the beginning, because I kept saying that humans are the only bipedal mammals, and you're right. There are hopping bipeds, like the kangaroo, and they are magnificently adapted for hopping locomotion. They can move 40 miles an hour. They've got these long tendons, these giant feet that store elastic energy and propel them as they're traveling in this energetically efficient kind of way. But one of the amazing things that I bumped into as I was researching this book, and I write about in one of my chapters, is that there are fossil kangaroos that are enormous. These were very, very large, 7-8 foot tall kangaroos that lived in Australia, obviously don't anymore, but we find their fossils. And the fossils themselves are inconsistent with the living kangaroos and their bodies that allow them to hop. And Christine Janis, who's a paleontologist, used to be, she did her work at Brown University in Providence. She made the argument that the skeletons were consistent with these kangaroos actually walking on two legs, walking bipedally. Can you imagine, right, going to Australia and seeing a standing, striding, walking kangaroo? And that's exactly what people would have seen when they first got to Australia. When humans first arrived in Australia, we have archaeological evidence of that going back about 65,000 years now. They would have seen, yes, the hopping kangaroos, but there were other giant kangaroos that would have been walking on two legs. They obviously don't exist anymore. And one of the great things about science, of course, is that you can have a hypothesis like Christine Janis's hypothesis that these kangaroos walked on two legs. And then you can test it with complementary evidence. And sure enough, just last year, there was the discovery of footprints in Australia, kangaroo footprints, and they indeed show a bipedal gait. They show a not a hopping gait, but a striding, walking gait. And so now we have independent evidence that kangaroos, at least one branch of the kangaroo family, experimented with striding bipedalism, but then went extinct because they're obviously not here anymore. And that's something that, you know, that seems to be a consistent pattern throughout evolutionary history, is that some of the early bipedal reptiles, many of the bipedal dinosaurs, bipedal kangaroos, the large ground sloths that we think occasionally could move on two legs, and most human ancestors, except for us, went extinct. That bipedalism seems to be a form of locomotion that just can't quite get its grip on surviving and persisting. And it's just a story of extinction until us. And here we are, not only not extinct, but now 8 billion strong and inflicting extinction on much of the rest of the living world.
Oh, that's fascinating. It's really humbling to know that something else already figured it out and then decided not to use it.
Yeah, right. Oh, and my favorite example, if I could, is there was a fossil discovered. This is a Triassic fossil, about 230 million years old, discovered in North Carolina by Lindsay Zano, who's a paleontologist at North Carolina State. And this is a crocodile, an ancient crocodile. And I went to North Carolina and met Dr. Zano and looked at this fossil and the skull. You can tell this is a crocodile or a crocodile skull or crocodilian, I should say. And yet it moved on two legs. And so we think about alligators and crocodiles, people often refer to them as living fossils, as though they you know, didn't change since the time of the dinosaurs. And they have. A lot of their ancestors actually were sprinting around on two legs, not lumbering about on all fours like the modern crocodile does. And so again, here's an example of bipedal locomotion not cutting it. And those individuals being more quadrupedal, surviving, preferentially surviving over the ones that were bipedal. With crocodiles, maybe it was because they could engage in stealth hunting a little bit more easily. It's not clear. But what is clear to me is that the advantages of bipedalism are not self-evident. That there are lots of organisms that were bipedal went extinct. And even in humans, there are so many disadvantages of being bipedal. We can talk about the advantages too, and I think we should, but bipedal locomotion makes humans one of the slowest mammals on the planet. We are exceptionally slow. Even the fastest human being who's ever existed as far as we know, Usain Bolt, the fastest he ever ran in his world record 100-meter race was 28 miles an hour. And that is half the speed of a galloping zebra or antelope, or more importantly, lion or leopard. That we could not outrun a predator, nor could we have ever outrun the things that would have eaten us.
We could also outrun our friend.
Well, I'm sorry?
We could outrun our friend.
I suppose that's a good point. But you know, as you start losing friends, eventually it's just you. And so
that's a good point too.
Right? So this presents this real dilemma of how could a locomotion evolve that is going to be disadvantageous to your survival, making us incredibly slow and unstable. When humans fall very often, there are about 25,000 Americans who die every year in a fall. We are unstable on our two legs. And then on top of that, we are particularly vulnerable when we are injured. So, you know, when I travel to Africa for my research, we often will see zebras and see other animals, and even out my window, I see deer very often that are limping. And so injuries can be handled by quadrupedal animals more easily, because they have three legs that they can walk on. Even if one is injured, they still have three. Well, if I badly injure one of my legs, what good is a uniped? What good is walking on one leg in an environment full of predators, which is what our ancestors would have faced? And yet we're here. And so obviously the advantages must have outweighed the disadvantages. But I think those disadvantages are particularly telling and important as we begin to round out this story of how did this form of locomotion persist, and why are we still here? How did we make it through the intense pressures of natural selection?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Interesting. So I was wondering whether it's known or being investigated whether the emergence and also the persistence of bipedalism coincided with the changes in the human brain circuitry and also expansion of certain cell types.
Oh, that's a fabulous question. So what we can tell from the fossil record is that bipedal locomotion long precedes brain enlargement. And that's just in by volume. We don't have a good way to measure, neuron density or anything like that, because all we're left with are the hard tissues, just the skull. And sometimes the skull fills up with sediment and hardens in a way that you get an impression of the brain. So you can see the different lobes and fissures and even impressions of some of the arteries. And on the inside of the skull, sometimes there are impressions for the flow of blood, for instance, draining the brain. And some researchers, Dean Falk, for instance, has hypothesized something called the radiator hypothesis, important changes in how we cooled our brain would have been necessary in order to sort of free us from these evolutionary shackles and allow for brain expansion. But how that relates to bipedalism is a little more unclear. One of the things that we do see in the fossil record is that once with a group we call Australopithecus, the earliest fossils that we find are from different genera that I sometimes cluster together in what's called Ardipithecus. These were the first bipeds, the first ancestors of ours that could move on two legs, but they also were very comfortable in the trees. The best skeleton that we have from Ethiopia, known as Ardi, has a grasping big toe, long arms, long curved fingers, and was clearly comfortable in the trees. But there's no evidence of knuckle walking in her hands or wrists. And so when she came to the ground, based on what we can tell from her pelvis and from the outside of her foot, she was able to push off the ground with her foot, using it as a kind of a stiff, rigid lever, like we have. And that allowed her to move on two legs, and it was good enough. And that kind of ape, what we can tell from the fossils right now, is that's the kind of ancient ancestor we had from about 4 to 7 million years ago. They had brains around the size of a chimpanzee's brain. But around 4 million years ago, we begin to get a new genus called Australopithecus. And Australopithecus, for your listeners, the most famous Australopithecus is Lucy, the skeleton Lucy. Discovered in Ethiopia. She's an Australopithecus afarensis. But now we have a whole bunch of different kinds of them. There are upwards of 10 different species of Australopithecus from Central Africa, Eastern Africa, Southern Africa that have been named. And the evidence that we can tell from the fossils, and one of the great surprises that I've been a part of in the last couple of years, is that different Australopithecus species walked in different ways. They actually had different mechanics of walking. There wasn't a one-size-fits-all mode of locomotion. And with Australopithecus, what we see is committed terrestrial bipedalism, where sure, they retain some features for getting up into a tree, and they almost certainly went up into the trees at night to avoid getting picked off by predators. They didn't have controlled fire yet, or any structures or anything to avoid being eaten at night. So their options are pretty limited, and going up into a tree seems pretty obvious to me. But during the day, they spent most of their time on the ground and foraged. And because of that, and because they're predators and because they're not fast, because they're bipedal, what we see is evidence for dietary expansion. Early human ancestors specialized on what we would call C3 resources. These are resources you can get mostly from wooded, forested environments. So think, you know, ripe fruit, like chimpanzees and what they eat. But with Australopithecus afarensis, Lucy species, and then carrying on right to today, what we see is dietary breath. Humans around the world eat everything, right? If it has DNA in it, we've tried it. We are not picky eaters as a species. As individuals, sure, but as a species, we are not picky eaters at all. So where did that dietary breath come from? And I think it comes from being a bipedal species on a landscape full of predators, navigating that landscape in a safe way, and making sure that you know you're not so picky that you eventually bump into the leopard hiding in the grass. No, you go out onto your landscape. Once the big cats go to sleep, so in the heat of the day, you go out onto your landscape and you eat everything you can, whether it's grasses or fruit or tubers or meat that you have to scrape off a kill from the night before, insects. You name it, and our ancestors were probably eating it. Now, the interesting thing about, and I'm eventually getting to your brain question, the interesting thing about bipedal locomotion is one of the interesting things, and one of the advantages to it, is just how energetically efficient it is. We are unbelievably energetically efficient. So we're slow. We're crazy slow. But moving from point A to point B, we use very little fuel by moving on two legs. And the best way to wrap your head around this is, if you wanted to lose a pound of weight, if you decided that you want to walk to lose a pound of weight, you would have to walk 70 miles. 70.
Whoa.
That's how energetically efficient we are.
You're gonna run out of the battery on your watch.
Exactly. We just do it too well. We're too efficient at it. So where does that energetic, early in human evolution, by moving on two legs and doing it in an efficient way, as we suspect from the bones and the footprints Australopithecus was doing, it frees up some energy. And some of that energy may have been reallocated to brain growth. And so early Australopithecus doesn't have a large brain. It has a brain around the size of a chimpanzee's. But by the time of Lucy, brains have gotten about 20% bigger. And one of the hypotheses that I present in the book is that bipedal locomotion helped free up some of that energy, because brains are so energetically expensive to grow. About 20% of our energy as adults goes to our brain. So where did that energy come from? I think it's linked to this form of locomotion. And one last thing that I'll mention about brains, they get much bigger later, obviously, with genus Homo. And with genus Homo, we also see expansion beyond the borders of Africa into Europe and into Asia, and the beginnings of a cosmopolitan, global, nearly global species. But there's this amazing fossil Australopithecus child that was found by Zerai Alemzigid in Ethiopia. It's a 2.5-year-old child. And the sandstone filled in the cavity of the skull and made an impression of the brain. And so we can get details of the brain anatomy, at least external, but we can also get details of the size of the brain. And the brain was about 75% done growing compared to the adults at the time this child died, at the age of 2.5. That is exactly what we see in humans today. In chimpanzees, by the time you're 2.5 years old as a chimpanzee, 90% of your brain is done growing. By the time you're 3 or 4, it's 100%. So chimpanzees who are, 3 or 4 years old, their brain volume-wise is done. There's still a lot of maturation to happen with the brain, but volume-wise it's done. But in humans, we don't reach full brain volume until we're 7 or 8 years old. And then again, lots of changes and maturation that happens, but volume-wise, 7 or 8 is when we reach our full brain size. And if you backtrack and look at a 2.5-year old, it's about 75% of the adult brain volume is complete by that point. And that's what we see in Australopithecus. And so they've slowed down their brain growth. And this is a terrible idea if you're on a landscape full of predators that are attacking you and eating you. Natural selection would accelerate your growth. You'd want to mature more quickly so that you could get to the reproductive phase and pass on your genes. How in the world were our ancestors able to slow down brain growth? What the researchers who worked on this study suggested, and I think they're absolutely right, is that we had a social buffer, that we were looking out for each other. We were socially protecting our group. And that buffer, that social buffer, is what allowed our kids at the time, 3 million years ago, to have slowed down brain growth, which would have been beneficial to their learning how to be an Australopithecus on that landscape. A lot of that neuronal development, which more about than I would, happening in an enriched environment over the course of many, many years, rather than just a couple as in a chimpanzee. And so, I started off earlier talking about just the downsides of bipedalism, and we're slow and we're unstable and we're on a landscape full of predators millions of years ago. How in the world did we survive? And I think this, amongst many other clues, points to us taking care of each other and providing this social buffer. And that's what allowed us to survive this really vulnerable time in our history.
Fascinating. So let's just switch to the cultural part then. And what roles did bipedalism play in our social history?
That's a fascinating question. So everyone walks a little bit differently, and that's going to be, you know, impacted by our biology, by our anatomy, but it's also impacted by our culture and what we see around us. Humans are very good at copying what we see around us, and so, you know, gaits are things that you know we adopt as we see individuals around us. And again, you know, it's affected by our biology as well. And so one of the really interesting things that I discovered in researching this book is that humans are so fine-tuned to picking up on subtle differences in gait. And it's a signal. Mm. It's a signal that we are able to communicate to one another. We can identify individuals by gait. And so one of the anecdotes that I present in the book is that I'm on the same college campus as my wife. And, you know, back pre-pandemic, when you know, we would walk across the green as I'm heading for lunch or something, I could see her on the other side of the green and recognize her just from her walk. And sure enough, it would be her. And so we can pick up on individuals just by the subtle differences in how they walk. Additionally, we can also pick up on mood. So, you know, think about somebody's slumped shoulders and slow dragging walk versus somebody who has a skip in their step. You can tell that first person is down, that second person is feeling pretty good. And these signals may have had some advantage in the evolutionary past as we are, you know, looking across a landscape and seeing either members of our own species or maybe other species of hominins, because not only do we have evidence of hominins millions of years ago sharing the landscape with lots of different kinds of upright walking hominins, but even Homo sapiens, even our own species, coexisted in Africa and beyond with different species of upright walkers. The one your listeners would know the best would be Neanderthals. Neanderthals we know now were not so different from us that we couldn't have babies with them. We genetically absorbed them into our own gene pool when humans interacted with Neanderthals at the overlapping of territories. But there were other populations. There was something called Homo naledi in South Africa that lived about 250,000 years ago. And Homo sapiens would have overlapped in time and space with Homo naledi. And Homo naledi was this incredibly surprising discovery that we made a couple of years ago in South Africa of a relatively recent hominin, 250,000 years old, that still had a really small brain. It had long legs, but tiny joints. And it had feet that were human-like, but not very well arched. And we suspect that it would have walked a little differently than humans do. And then the best example is an incredible discovery made on the island of Flores, in the Indonesian archipelago, of a tiny little upright walking creature that was nicknamed the Hobbit, which is the species name is Homo floresiensis. And it too was unusual in having body proportions like a Australopithecus. It had long arms and short legs. It had huge feet for its body size, and a tiny brain. And it lived up until 50,000 years ago. So Homo sapiens, we would have seen this thing. We would have bumped into it. Now it's gone now, and we can speculate on what happened. And many have. We're not sure. We don't have any direct evidence for that interaction between Homo sapiens and Homo floresiensis, but it too would have walked differently with those giant feet and short legs. I can sort of imagine it walking like it has snowshoes on, lifting its legs high and to avoid tripping over its own toes. And so what I'm getting to here is that different species walking differently may have been an important thing for humans to be able to recognize, to know whether the approaching group is your own species or not, to know whether the approaching group, if it is your species, consists of individuals that are happy or sad, that it consists of individuals that have just gone through conflict. Is anyone limping? Are they going to need help? Are they going to need care? So all of that information, you know, walking is not just a way to get from point A to point B. It contains information. And a lot of that information would have been useful in the past. And then even today, this is information that we still communicate to one another in mood, in identifying individuals, but then also, you know, all these sort of, you know, cultural trends in gait, whether it be a, you know, a skip, or think about, you know, Dorothy skipping down the to Oz, right? Or
also the newer one, the smartphone slouch.
Yes, exactly. Right. You could absolutely tell from a distance if somebody's on their phone, even if their back is turned. That slow walk, that slouch. And you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is are some of the important physical and mental benefits of walking as well. One of the surprising things that I learned was that it's been identified in the last couple of decades since I took physiology in college that muscle acts as an endocrine organ and actually can produce what are called myokines. And there are hundreds now that have been identified that then travel throughout your body and have benefits. Both physical and mental benefits in terms of warding off disease, warding off cardiovascular disease and stroke and diabetes, but also benefits to your to memory. There are some myokines that target the amygdala. Excuse me. That walking has all of these important benefits. But back to your, sorry, I have to cough again. Sorry about that. But back to your original question. I want to recognize just the sort of ableist and privileged angle that I take and others have taken that I write in this book about walking. I just had a class with my students where we talked about walking as something that is gendered. And in the world we live in right now, and probably into the past as well, how easy it is for a man to just go for a walk, a white man especially. All of my students were talking about, you know, getting out during the pandemic and going for a walk, and then just having to deal with harassment and having to deal with catcalling. And, you know, I was just reading a story as well about a black man in Texas who was walking home from Walmart after the ice storm that hit Texas last week. And he was just walking home and he was arrested. He was in the street because the sidewalk was icy, hadn't been plowed, and he was arrested for walking in the street. You know, we can't run that experiment again, but my guess is if he was white, that wouldn't have happened. So walking also pulls in these other much larger, much more important issues of social justice and injustice. You know, we celebrate these lone walks that Thoreau and Darwin and many other, you know, famous folks, Steve Jobs famously would walk around the Apple campus. It's usually white men. And that's something that I think we need to, you know, I grapple with a little bit in the book. Antonia Malchik wrote a book called A Walking Life in 2019. And for your listeners who are interested in that aspect of walking, I would recommend her book. Antonia Malchik's book is just brilliant and talks about the world we've constructed around walking. and writes a lot more than I do about the world we've constructed for mostly is a world for cars, and so walking itself is difficult. But even in places where walking is possible, we've constructed a world that's really difficult for those who don't walk. And so, in that way, walking itself is you know takes on this quite an ableist connotation, I suppose. It was one of the reasons in the subtitle of the book, where I talk about you know, the book's called First Steps: How Upright Walking Made Us Human. It was important to me that it was not how upright walking makes us human. There are so many people who don't walk, and that doesn't make them in any way, shape, or form any less human.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do try to write about is that one of the things that I end the book with is a story of a fossil that I worked on that was discovered in Kenya in the 1970s, and it's an amazing fossil. It's just the end of a shin bone, and yet we can learn so much about the individual who possessed that shin bone and died 2 million years ago in Kenya. It appears to be from a young adult because it has a somewhat open growth plate still. It's detectable, but the individual is done growing. So think about somebody, you know, 18 to 20 years old. It's very small, consistent with the size of Lucy. And so we think it might've been from an osteological female, about 70 pounds. Definitely from an upright walker. It has all the hallmarks of that. You know, Homo habilis or Australopithecus boisei. We have a couple of species living at that time, but the most amazing thing to me is that it has a healed ankle fracture. Mm-hmm. So 2 million years ago, you are a hominin on your landscape and you break your ankle, broken ankle, right? You step into a ditch or you fall from a tree, break your ankle. There's no way you should have survived. You're already slow and now you've broken an ankle. That should have been the end of this individual, but it wasn't. It was a healed ankle fracture. And so to me, that tells us that tells me that other individuals were helping this one out, got this individual into a tree, brought them food, brought them water, whatever they needed to survive.
Mm-hmm.
They were buffered from, you know, because of the behavior of others, the compassion of others, the care, the empathy, that humans, you know, as bad as we can be to each other, we also have this wonderful aspect to us that we are caring, compassionate, trusting, empathetic primates. And I think that starts back with the origins of bipedalism and connects us right back to the individuals today that lose a limb and can't walk and don't walk. And we as a society take care of them and provide the resources, or at least should provide the resources that those individuals need to continue to live a healthy and happy life.
Yes, absolutely. And you bring out absolutely crucial point that even the history of locomotion can teach us so much about social justice that we should take a lot of, turn a lot of our attention to.
Exactly. Yep. That's right.
All right. So, it's absolutely captivating read with very beautiful artwork, your book, and looking at your front cover also makes me think about the x-rays of those feet on high heels. So I'm sure our listeners are going to really enjoy it. So we've taken up a lot of your time, and I would like to, well, I'm afraid to ask about your next project. It's probably going to be something like astrobiogeology.
not quite. No, I mean, there's so many fossils that continue to be discovered. And there are new ones coming out of South Africa. There's some beautiful new fossils coming out, even older fossils coming out of Germany, colleagues of mine, Lee Berger and Madeline Burma. And so there's a lot of work still to be done. There's so many things we still don't truly understand about the origins and evolution of this unique form of locomotion. So I'm not done with bipedalism. I'm still thinking about it and still working on it. And once it is safe to do so, My plan is to return to Tanzania, to the site of Laetoli, where there are famous footprints, and continue to search. Because on the basis of what we found back in 2019, my guess is there are many, many, many more still to be found.
Excellent. So where can our listeners find more about your work and the book as well?
So my book can be found on the HarperCollins website. So if you just search for Jeremy Da Silva First Steps, you can find that book. I also have a website where they can learn a lot more about the research I do, and I've got a number of educational videos that I've posted. And that is sites.dartmouth.edu/DaSilva, my last name. Or just Google my name and you can find that website pretty easily. So my recommendation would be to order, you know, if you're interested in the book, you want to read the book, to order it through your local bookstore, local bookstores, or a local science museum. Local bookstores and science museums are really struggling right now in the pandemic, and they could use all the help we can give them.
Oh, that's an excellent message. Yes. All right. So that has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining me today. And also I would like to thank you for the opportunity to say good luck with your mammoth.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.